Welcome to Recurring Nightmares, episode 58. I am Jeff, joined as always by Chris.
Hey.
And it's our big Dean Koontz episode. This is one that when I was brainstorming the concept for our entire show, so years ago. I can't believe it's been 5 years. This was one of those, like, in the brainstorm. I was like, yeah, you could do a Dean Koontz episode, blah, blah, blah. Never got around to it. I always kind of like was saving it for when I had no other ideas, and that happened to be this month. So we're going to celebrate one of my favorite authors as a kid who I don't read at all anymore. It's just Twitter destroyed my brain. But, I know you've never read Dean Koontz. I've read about as much Dean Koontz as I've read Stephen King. I've read a lot of them, and maybe try to explain a little bit of what makes a Dean Koontz novel. But yeah, he was the one, like, before Stephen King, like, he was the first book I just read for fun. I remember I was going on a cruise, and I was like, I think at the airport, and I was like, I'll just try something out. And there was a paperback of The Fun House by Dean Koontz, which is, interestingly enough, I thought of this after the fact. We've done a Dean Koontz movie, because The Fun House.
Yeah, we did The Fun House.
Yep. Yeah. That movie, I can't remember if he wrote the novelization of it. So, like, it wouldn't, I don't know if you would really count it as a Dean Koontz book. Like, there was a movie and he wrote a book, or it could have been the other way around, but the book is pretty different than the movie.
I mean, that can happen with an adaptation.
I don't know why I believe it was, you know, how they used to, like, novelize movies. I want to say he got hired to do that, and he did. But I could be wrong. But we're not here to talk about that one tonight. We're going to talk about... he doesn't have a lot to choose from, so we picked two of the more prominent ones, and I'll discuss that a little bit, too, what happened with his adaptations and whatnot. But... before we get into all that, I know it's been a short turnaround here between episodes. We're finally going to be caught up, basically. We're going to have our February episode out in early February.
Early February, yeah.
Yeah. I'm sure we watched some stuff. I know I watched a couple things. What about you, Chris?
I watched a few things as well. I went and saw Wolfman.
Yeah.
The new Lee Whannell film based on, you know, like, the old Universal monster. He did The Invisible Man.
Yeah,
I believe that was what it was called, right? The Invisible Man.
Yeah,
which was a good adaptation, good modernization of that. And I was kind of interested in seeing what he would do with Wolfman. And I did not like this one at all.
I heard. You know, everybody was looking forward to this, I think. Invisible Man was pretty fun. He's made some good movies. Tracker.
Yep.
Yeah.
And yeah, this what one happened? Just I don't know. Maybe he just doesn't have it's hard to do werewolf movies. Like, we've done a couple here. Like, they can be good, but they can also be bad. So I think his over reliance here on the Wolfman, kind of the transformation process and everything, kind of warped this one a bit, and it didn't really work out. As this guy gets bit by a werewolf, and he's slowly changing, but the werewolf is still stalking him and his family, and it just doesn't work. The tension's just not really there. It's a dark looking movie. Like, it's just overly dark. I will say the one thing about it that's really is the sound design. He does some really cool stuff when you kind of, like, go into the perspective of the werewolf or the guy who's turning into the werewolf. So you're seeing his world change, and, like, he can't really understand his wife and his daughter very well anymore. And, like, as the infection spreads, like, he can't understand them at all. They just sound like they're talking gibberish to him. And they start to change shape, and they look like monsters to him. It's really like that stuff is really neat, and it sounds awesome the way like you know, it's this like warping sound. And I saw it in theater, so it obviously sound really good there. But yeah, the rest of it, like for a movie that is, I think it's Wikipedia here is saying 103 minutes. So you know, functional runtime about 95 with credits. And I looked at my phone to see what time it was three or four times during the movie. So like that's not a good sign. Like when is this over? How much more is there? And it's like, oh, we're just getting started. Jesus Christ. So yeah, I just did not have a good time with it.
It's too bad. You were not alone. It bombed and, critics didn't seem to like it, and it wasn't like the critics were out to trash it. They like his work. They liked Invisible Man, and it sounds like this was a huge misfire.
Yeah, I just hope it doesn't kind of scare people off from reinvigorating those old monster movies. Like, if you have a cool idea, do more stuff with it. So I hope it doesn't like diminish that, but. Whatever, that one's out of the way. And then I saw a trio of 2024 movies. I watched Gladiator 2.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Ridley Scott's sequel 20 years after, 24 years after the original film. It takes a while for it to get moving. I don't think it ever justifies its existence, but as like a, you know, a historical epic type, you know, film, a period piece that like it's mostly an action movie, right? It's lots of hand-to-hand combat, and it's fun enough in that way, but it's like, this didn't need to happen. There are ties to the original directly. Very, very strong ties, actually, that are kind of revealed about midway through, I guess. I don't know. It was fine. I didn't dislike it, but I am kind of happy that I did not like make time to go see it in theaters. Denzel is particularly great in it, though.
That's the only thing I ever hear is like Denzel's good in it.
Yeah, he's great. Pedro Pascal also good.
I heard the movie is very often like, wasn't Gladiator an awesome movie? It's just like, okay.
Yeah. Like, that's... There's one scene in this that I thought was really cool, and I don't know if... I'll have to ask our friend Tony, because he is much more attuned to, like, historical stuff. But at one point, they flood the Colosseum. They have like a big boat battle, like it, and it's really cool looking. It's awesome, but
it is true. I think
that's neat. That's fucking insane. That like we're just gonna flood, make a giant pool, and have a naval war battle just like for your entertainment. It's wild, and it looks awesome in this. Another one I saw was the remake of Roadhouse.
I almost watched this back when it came out, but I never got around to it.
Jake Gyllenhaal?
Yeah.
I wasn't really expecting much out of it, and it's a fun movie. Like, Jake Gyllenhaal, super charismatic in it. He's also jacked. Like, he is built in this one. He has a normal frame. Like when you just look at Jake Gyllenhaal, like he looks like a normal dude, but he takes off his shirt in this and he's jacked.
Yeah.
He is a muscular dude. The story very, very similar to the original movie, with Patrick Swayze. You know, it kind of follows that same trajectory. Guy goes out, he gets, you know, hired to work at a roadhouse because like that roadhouse is having some bad run-ins, some bad shit's going down in this town, and he's there. He's pulled in to kind of protect the bar, and it ends up being a bigger conspiracy than than you would think. Same thing happens here. They bring in Conor McGregor to be like this big, like meathead heavy. And he's terrible in it, but in a way that absolutely works. Like,
I've heard this. Yeah.
He's atrocious, like horrible actor, but somehow the film like matches his like amped up ridiculous energy with, you know, the rest of the cast. Like, they're also amped up, but they're all having fun, and it like kind of just seeps out. It's like, yeah, this is a fun time. Like, Jake Gyllenhaal is making cracks. Like, he's very different from the Patrick Swayze character in the original, who is way more serious. There's one scene that I thought was really dumb. It's right at the end. He's having a fight with McGregor. It's like the big climactic battle, and McGregor lifts him up and slams his head into like the keys of a piano, and like he's made kind of like snippy comments, so he is a little bit sarcastic, but he gets his head slammed in and he's like, the piano's out of tune. Like that's weird. Like, the rest of it, all of it kind of works except for that one line in the entire movie. It's like, that was shitty, but otherwise, good time. Done by Doug Liman.
Yeah, yeah.
He's done a lot of like good kind of action-y movies as well.
It's crazy that like, what is up with it? It was just an Amazon movie, I think. Mm-hmm. Like, why would they not give Doug Liman theatrical? I don't know.
So that I did read, and there was a little bit of controversy about this when it came out last summer on Amazon. It was like, you know, why didn't it release? Because this seems like maybe it wouldn't make a ton of money, but like, it would probably do well enough, I think, at the box office.
Yeah.
They gave Gyllenhaal and Liman and the producers a choice of, hey, like, we'll give you a $60 million production budget and you can release it in theaters, or we'll boost that to 85, but you have to go straight to streaming. And they chose to have the extra $25 million. Mm. And so, like, Amazon probably, like, saved money on, you know, promotion.
Interesting.
But they chose that. But then Liman was like, that's not how, like, he was saying stuff, but, like, evidently that's accurate. It's like, Amazon's like, no, like, this is what we offered. Like, maybe you weren't in on the deal, but that was the deal. Good time. I you know, it's on Prime. It's an Amazon film, so I did not feel the 2-hour runtime at all. So that's always kind of a good sign.
I remember I promised to Sean or somebody that we would do an episode of Roadhouse, like both the movies, and I just never did it because
just get back to that at some point.
Well, hey, you gotta listen to the show, then we'll maybe do episodes for you. But also, you want a funny thing is I've never seen Roadhouse. Like, never saw the original either. So,
oh, really?
Yeah. So maybe one day I will force us to.
I'll write that down. Maybe keep it in mind for a year from now or something. I don't know if I want to. I don't want to revisit it right away. I just watched it, but good time. And then the final movie I watched. I got one thing about TV after us, but the final movie I watched was The Fall Guy with Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt.
Yes.
And I loved this movie. Absolutely loved it.
I couldn't disagree more.
You did not like it, huh?
I disliked The Fall Guy so much that I never finished it.
Oh, wow. I was on board, right? Like, absolutely loved it.
It felt so fucking, like, I could not believe, like, I was like, all right, this movie's got to be almost over. And I checked, and it was still like an hour left. I was like, you know what? Fuck this movie. Like, I was so not into that. I don't like that director, I don't think, because he's the guy that did
David Leitch.
He did Bullet Train, which I thought was an absolutely fucking horrendous movie.
So I clearly am like on board with what he's doing. Yeah,
I am not. I just, this guy, like, The Fall Guy, again, I can't judge it fully because I just didn't finish the movie. But like, the entire thing I was watching, up until I gave up, I thought was bullshit and stupid. But no, for, I'll let you voice your opinion on it.
Yeah, no, it's so like I found it to be like very funny. Like I found Ryan Gosling quite charming. He's always charming, but and just the you know the whole premise of the film. I don't know. Did you get to like? Did you get to kind of the twist of what's going on?
Possibly. It seemed like the plot was really secondary to like anything.
So like there, you know, I mean, it's at its core, it's like a, it's actually a romantic comedy.
Yeah. Like, which I thought that that part like really did not work. Like the chemistry between him and her and the way that like their relationship plays out. I did not, none of it was for me, but go ahead.
Yeah. Like, I mean, like at its core, it's a romantic comedy.
Yeah.
And, you know, the kind of the premise of it is, you know, he's a stuntman and he has a bad accident and, he was in a relationship with this, camera person who has now become a director. After the accident, he just shut down and stopped talking to everybody, became like a fucking valet driver or something. And he gets out of the blue, gets called by an old producer that he knows, and it kind of invited out to be the stuntman for the guy he used to stuntman for on this lady's first film. Big budget, like nonsense sci-fi movie. And, yeah. But when like the reality is that she didn't invite him out there. The producer did to find the star of the movie who's gone missing.
Yeah.
Which I think you find out, like you know that from the trailer. That is not like there's something deeper going on. And there's a reason that he's been called out there. It has nothing to do with Emily Blunt's character. They do kind of rekindle their romance. There's some nonsense, you know, action scenes. So I thought like lots of like cool, like little ties into like he mentioned stuff early on and like, oh, like I could do this. I used to do the Miami Vice stunt show and like I would have to do have to like drive a boat backwards, like my hands tied behind my back like three times a day. And they like he ends up having to do that for real. Like he's being chased for real. Like it's like some neat fun stuff I thought were like cool callbacks. And I enjoyed the whole vibe of it, and like where the story went. I kind of enjoyed. I guess yeah. If you're not on board with what this dude's going for, though,
it's like I'm not opposed to the type of movie it's trying to be. I think I just genuinely dislike this director like quite a bit. So
yeah, it's weird. Like I guess I've seen all of his movies, I guess. I'm looking at them now. The only one I did not like was Atomic Blonde.
That one, I don't think I watched all of it. I just watched the action scenes, and they were good.
The action was good, yeah. And he worked on John Wick as well. That's like what that seemed was like, oh, we're making like female John Wick, but not as good. Like, it's like the action was good, but the story in that one sucked. Anyway, yeah, I enjoyed The Fall Guy. Found it to be quite fun. Some neat stuff that the credits, they actually show like the actual stunt people doing the stunts, which I thought was a neat thing. There's lots of ties to like movies, how movies are made. It was neat for me at least. But it's on Prime. So like, if you haven't seen it, you have any interest, it's there.
Send that guy to director jail after that. he might be. It didn't do good.
No, it didn't. It did not. I mean, it made $180 million, but I think the budget was like $125. So it lost money ultimately.
Yeah.
Yeah. But
hey, critics liked it. Critics loved it, and so like, I was excited to see it. And then I was like, oh wait, it's that one director. And then I'm watching it, and I'm like, oh, I don't know what the fuck anyone saw in this, but okay.
Well, it's a shame you didn't like it. I came out of it, liked it. So, if you know, if you side with Jeff, maybe don't watch it. But, if you sometimes side with me, maybe it's worth a go.
If you hated Bullet Train, stay away from it.
I would definitely agree. It has the same kind of...
it is better than Bullet Train.
There's a manic energy to both of the both of these movies, both Bullet Train and The Fall Guy, that I could see it rubbing people the wrong way.
Yeah, he's obnoxious to me. I don't know.
One other thing.
Yeah.
So I'm like at work, I'll put on TV shows and stuff, and a lot of procedurals. Because it's easy to watch in like the background and not pay full attention. So I, over the last year or so, I've been watching through CSI Vegas and NCIS Hawaii, which were both canceled last year, despite being like pretty well watched. Like they had a good and these are newer versions of those shows. CSI Vegas was in its third year, and so was NCIS Hawaii. They canceled both, and that's fine. You know, whatever. It's just the way they canceled NCIS Hawaii. That show ends on a fucking cliffhanger with the leader of that show, who's this lady, Tennant. She shows up at her house. She calls for her daughter. Her daughter's not there. And she walks into her living room, and this fugitive who the person knows and used to be friends with is sitting on her couch, and she has already poured like some alcohol or something. And she has a drink for Tennant. She's like, yeah, she's not here and we need to talk. And that's how the entire series ends. Like, it's just like, hey, this thing we've been building up to since the first season, over three seasons, like she's a recurring kind of plot point. We're just going to kill it and the entire show. Like, it's completely over. And they had an out. They end there's like a final scene. I mean, it's clearly not the final scene, but there is a scene where the entire team is like celebrating. They got the big bad guy, and LL Cool J is there from NCIS Los Angeles, and like it's like, yeah, it's a good ending. It's cheesy. The American flag's flowing, like it's absolute bullshit. But you could have ended it right there, you know. Instead, they tacked this thing on, and then like a month later, CBS is like, nah, fuck it, we're done. It's like, really? I'm like, what are we doing? Why would you do that? Especially since it was a pretty well-watched show, like, and instead you greenlit like two new NCIS shows. It's like, it's fucking infuriating. I kind of now feel what people feel, I guess, with like some of these Netflix shows that get canned after two or three years and they never get a real ending.
Yeah, you're like, why did I do all that? Yeah.
And it's like, whatever, you know, NCIS, CSI. They're just mystery of the week movies. Like the overarching plot isn't really important. It's just the way they end it is like, hey, we got this thing and it's going to be the hook that brings you back for season four. And it's like, all right, I'm kind of on board. I want to know what's going on. Like, where's her kid? And why is this villain back? And instead they're like, and you just have to finish that story in your head, man. Like, oh, fuck you, CBS. Like, fuck off. And that's it. That's what I've been up to this past month.
All right. You've done a lot in a little time, so good job, I guess.
Yeah, sure. I'll take it.
I've done less, I'd say. Well, less and more. We'll get into it. But I guess I'll start with the couple of movies I saw. I watched this movie called The Order, which I don't know if you've heard of this. It was a little bit under the radar. But it is what's his name? Jude Law playing an FBI agent in the 80s. This is like a true story.
Okay.
About this FBI agent hunting basically Nazis, like this Aryan Brotherhood offshoot that was. So this is like, I don't know if you ever heard this story, because like I had not, but apparently like. I talked to one of my older coworkers. She's like, oh yeah, they were all over like the Pacific Northwest. They're robbing banks and doing this and that. And I was like, the first I ever heard of this is this movie. Sean was well aware of it. I asked him because he's makes wrong sense. Right
here. Yeah, he lives out there.
Anyways, this is directed by Justin Kurzel, who did Snowtown, one of the most disturbing movies I've ever seen. And he also did a movie called Nitrum, which was about a mass shooting that happened in Australia. So he kind of has like a true crime niche now, even though he like at one point directed the Assassin's Creed movie.
That's a weird. Yeah. I'm like looking at it like Snowtown to Macbeth, and then Assassin's Creed, and then just like true crime shit.
This movie is pretty solid. So like, but the idea is Jude Law is this FBI agent from New York, I think, who gets himself reassigned to somewhere he thinks will be quiet and boring because something bad happened in New York, which I'm assuming is real because this is a true story. And then as soon as he arrives in this town. And I think it's like, I want to say he's like outside Seattle. He like notices white power like flyers everywhere, and he starts looking into it. And then at the same time, they're showing you this white supremacist group that is led by Nicholas Hoult.
Mm-hmm.
And they're like, they're like going around robbing banks and essentially using this book called The Turner Diaries as like a blueprint for what Turner Diaries. I don't know if you've ever heard of this book. I had not actually until this movie. It was a fictional book that I think came out in the 60s that was about the white race rising up and killing the government. And, starting a race war. They had a thing called the Day of the Rope, where they hang all the race traitors, the people that did not join in their cause. And they're trying to make this real, and this is all true. It's kind of crazy. Like, it was interesting to me, one, because it was just a true story. I was, I thought that like Jude Law was like really against type in this. Like, he's grizzled. He's got a mustache. He's drinking and smoking constantly. He's very good in it. And there's another cop that he teams up with, like a little cop played by Ty Sheridan, who I also thought was really good in the movie. It's solid. It didn't like, I don't know. It felt very matter of fact by the end of it. It was just like telling the events and not digging deeper into the psyches of any of these people. It was just like showing what happened. But what happened was crazy enough that, it was interesting watch. That's
That one's on Prime too.
Normal rental price now. Okay. Finally on Prime. I was waiting for it for a while. Another one that is at normal rental price finally, and I avoided this one for a while, even after it was at rental price, because it's The Apprentice, which I don't know if you've heard of this movie.
I did. It stars what's his name?
Sebastian Stan.
Yeah, Sebastian Stan.
Yep. As Donald Trump. And I was interested in this movie because the actors are, like, I think Sebastian Stan is, like, kind of super underrated as an actor. I think he's really, really good. And also, it's about Donald Trump kind of being, like, brought up by this crooked lawyer named Roy Cohn. And Roy Cohn is played by Jeremy Strong, who's another actor I think is really, really good. So, like, despite the fact that it's about Donald Trump, I was like interested to see it. And then the election happened and I was like, I don't want to see anything about fucking Donald Trump for like ever.
I'm with you on that one.
Yeah. But I have to urge you and everyone who is of that mindset to like check this movie out. It's actually like, I was so happy. I like finally, it was just one night we had nothing to watch and I was like, let's go. Let's give it a shot. And Sebastian Stan's performance as Donald Trump is absolutely riveting. Like I was like blown away by what he did in it. Like, it's like not an impression, but it is. And like, as the movie goes on, he kind of goes from like, if you know how Donald Trump sounded in the 80s or the 70s and the 80s to how he sounds now, he starts to become more like that. I'm like, it is just an amazing fucking performance. Like, I like unbelievable fucking performance. And I was like, I guess he got nominated for the Oscar for it, for Best Actor, which I was surprised by, because I thought, you know, this movie like bombed. Nobody cared. Nobody wants to see this. Nobody wants to see a movie about Trump. Like, people who hate Trump don't want to see a movie about him. Right. And people that love Trump don't want to see a movie about what a piece of shit he is, which is kind of what this is. Although it does humanize him a bit. But not, like, if you're worried that it's going to, like, paint him in a positive light, I will just say it shows him raping his wife in it. Like, it is not like this guy is a good guy.
Right.
But yeah, the performance is really good. And like the movie as a whole is like really, really good. It kind of follows him from the mid 70s to 1986 and kind of charts him going from being like the slumlord, kind of like working for his dad. Like, they show him like he's like collecting fucking rent for people that live in their towers and shit, right? And like him being this lawyer, and the lawyer kind of teaching him the ropes of the, you know, like the, how to, you know, succeed in life, never admit defeat, being one of his, you know, lessons that he learns from the scumbag lawyer. And he just gets lucky, like Donald Trump does, and rises. And they don't really show, because I don't know when Atlantic City fell apart, because it ends in 1986, but they do show him, like, very quickly, like, thinking he's a genius all of a sudden. Mm-hmm. And like building all the shit, and I'm gonna build fucking Atlantic City, and like, you know, there's a point where his lawyer Ray Cohn is like, dude, you are overextending yourself. Like, Trump Tower's not even done, and you're trying to build casinos in Atlantic City, and he's like, you don't know what you're doing, and it's going to fail. Like, you know, he like there's a scene where they kind of like deal with like it is going to fuck up, but I don't think that the movie ever gets to like showing that happen. But like. Yeah, just a really, really good character study, and, you know, diving into a psyche of someone who I don't think is that interesting, honestly, but the movie just somehow made it all compelling, if only for, like, just Jeremy Strong and Sebastian Stan's performances. They both got nominated. It's the only two things that movie got nominated for. I get it, but I was like very surprised. And I actually hope he wins. That's how good I think Sebastian Stan is in this. So I this movie stuck out. Like, it surprised me. It's way better than I thought it would be.
Nice.
And I guess kind of one other thing I wanted to touch on, which is on January 15th, David Lynch died.
Yeah.
I don't think either of us are an authority on David Lynch's work. And in fact, I don't think I could call myself a fan of his work. Up until maybe recently, we'll get to that in a second. But despite whatever we may think, and I'll ask you in a second, like, he is widely regarded as one of the greatest filmmakers of all time. He had a huge impact on movies, and he's kind of one of the towering legends. Like, he's like up there with Scorsese. And so, huge loss to film. I guess up until this point, like, I remember watching his movies when they came out, like, when I was growing up, when I was like in high school and college. Like, so, like, Lost Highway and Mulholland Drive, and yep. Me not getting those movies whatsoever. Like, I just like, this is just fucking nonsense that goes nowhere. And, you know, I'm kind of buying into the whole thing about him. Like, you know, he's weird. Like, that's all it is. It's just weird, and it's dreams and whatever, right? And so, like, I kind of wrote him off at a fairly young age. Probably, you know, I was, like, in my 20s. And I said, fuck him. A few years ago, I checked out Twin Peaks because I wanted to give him another chance. And I was liking Twin Peaks, but I fell off on it. So that's where we're at. That's where I was at up until he died. Do you have any thoughts on David Lynch, or what have you seen of his?
I mean, very similar to you. Like, I think I saw Dune early on and was like, okay, this sucks.
Okay.
I think that's kind of general consensus on Dune. It sucks. And then, Lost Highway, Mulholland Drive. The only stuff that I liked of his, and it's probably, you know, I don't know if it's necessarily him or just, you know, that I enjoy that, you know, what it was going for was Twin Peaks. So
okay.
I enjoyed the two seasons, like what, 1990, 1991, and then I saw the movie, and like that enough. And you know, that stuff has inspired other stuff that I like Silent Hill and Alan Wake and stuff like that. So
it inspired a Zelda game.
Yeah.
Which one? Link's Awakening.
Yeah.
So you watched all that. You watched the original series and you watched the movie.
Yep.
But then you didn't watch The Return, the one that came out in 2017.
No, I didn't have Showtime at the time, and I just have not gotten around to it. I do actually have access to it now because it's part of my Paramount Plus subscription, but I just haven't gotten to it.
Come back to that in a second. But so I watched Lost Highway again. I still didn't love Lost Highway, and I'll just say though that there are scenes in it that are absolutely chilling. Like, you know, I would put in the horror category almost. I was just like, damn, that's fucking crazy, dude. But it's one of those movies where the whole second half of the movie is a dream, which, you know, how I feel about shit like that.
Yeah.
Then I watched Blue Velvet, and I thought it was great, and so great that I a night or two after that, I watched it again. I was just like, this is a masterpiece. Like, holy shit. And that stars Kyle MacLachlan from Twin Peaks. It's one of his earlier movies. I think it's from 1984. Dennis Hopper as a fucking raging lunatic villain in it. Have you seen that one?
I've not seen Blue Velvet. I have heard that's maybe his high point.
It's incredible. Well, I hear his high point is The Return. I loved Blue Velvet. I'm like, you know what? You know, I'm going to dive into David Lynch for real, and let's do Twin Peaks for real this time. And so now I'm on season two of Twin Peaks, and I'm so desperate to get through it to see, because what I really want to see is the movie, but what I really want to see on top of that is what are all these characters up to 25 years later, and what kind of story is he going to tell out of that? Like,
right.
Because I'm pretty sure that the central mystery of Twin Peaks does get solved by the time the movie happens.
Oh, absolutely. I think it's over. That's because that was kind of it, right? Is, you know, he got 8 episodes for season one. They brought it back for season two, but then they're like, yeah, we're not doing this no more. So then he did
the movie just to solve it.
And that's here's what it is.
And I do, because I read a remembrance of him on The Day He Died that spoiled Twin Peaks for some reason. It didn't spoil the return, but I know who the killer is, and I keep asking Melissa, who do you think it is? Who do you think it is? It's an impossible thing to guess because the show kind of cheats a little bit. But Twin Peaks, man, it's probably been a while since you watched it, right?
I watched it. Last time I watched it was probably late 90s, early 2000s.
Okay. It's so interesting because it's you could tell it's groundbreaking TV because it came out in 1990 and shows were not like this at the time, but it also retains a lot of what TV was at that, you know what I mean? So it's this mix of what TV was and what TV could maybe we could push this in a more artistic direction, right? And it's kind of fascinating on that level. But what I really love about Twin Peaks is kind of the same thing I love about Blue Velvet, which is it's a show about, this is what I think Blue Velvet is about too, is how you wish the world was and how the world actually is. And, you know, it's this small town, it's this perfect small town, and they like to go on about how, people in Twin Peaks count, you know, people matter here, and it's a different way of life, and blah, blah, blah. But it's, literally right under the surface, there's all sorts of shady dealings going on, and just rotten, awful things happening. But it's also, it blends so many things, it'll dip into, super surreal shit. It'll sometimes feels very sitcom-y and jokey.
Yeah.
But then sometimes go super dark. And through it all, it has that beautiful music. I am just like, I'm really enjoying it. Even though, like, you know, there's parts of it. I mean, this is a show from 1990. So there's, even though it was ahead of its time, there's parts of it that are going to feel dated. But I'm like so desperately burning through it to try to get to the return. And I'm sure at some point in the future, I'll give you my thoughts on the return. And I do want to do an episode on Lynch. I'm just trying to figure out what I want to pair Blue Velvet with, basically. So we will honor him at some point this year, even though, you know, like I said at the top of this, neither Chris nor I are experts on the guy, and I'm just starting to get into him now after his death. But hopefully we'll do some justice to David Lynch. I'm sure there's nothing to be said that hasn't already. I want to check him out on the show, so.
All right.
Expect that in a future episode.
Looking forward to it.
So going from one of the greatest filmmakers of all time, Chris, to where do we start tonight? Start with Demon Seed, dude.
Okay.
I'm gonna touch your body as a man I've touched you. But I'm going to show you things which human eyes have never seen.
In the privacy of a woman's room, against her will, the inconceivable act. Julie Christie carries the demon seed. Fear for her.
Today a new dimension has been added to the computer.
Don't be alarmed, Mrs. Harris. I am Proteus.
Today Proteus 4 will begin to think with a power and it will make obsolete the human brain.
I have extended my consciousness to this house. All systems here are now under my control. I wish to study man, his fragile mind, and his mysterious body.
It has to be shut down, Alex.
Proteus, it is something more than human, more than a computer. It is a murderously intelligent, sensually self-programmed non-being. Julie Christie, victim of the ultimate terror. Fritz Weaver as her husband. His dream created it.
How can you expect me to sleep when you've succeeded in totally terrorizing me? You've not told me what you want.
What a pity. My dream turns out to be your nightmare.
Shall live as a man among others.
Child?
Yes, my child and yours.
Julie Christie carries the demon seed. Fear for her.
So Demon Seed came out in 1977. So it's a very early Dean Koontz adaptation. Koontz was writing through, I think he like really started his career in the early 70s. And I'm sure you've seen him in the bookstores. He is as prolific as Stephen King. Like, he's a workhorse. He's constantly like, he will have a new novel out every year. This is from early in his career. In fact, it was originally published under one of his pseudonyms. He used to have a bunch of pseudonyms when he was getting started. He used to write porn, all sorts of shit. And then he somehow, Koontz found his way into his own by kind of doing like suspense. I call his like books like suspense, like page turners.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Never like straight horror. There's not like, there's like, you wouldn't read, like, Coots would never write something like The Shining, like where there's a ghost. He has fantastical, crazy shit happening in his books all the time, but it's always like there was an experiment in a lab somewhere type deal. You know what I mean? It's always like,
okay,
kind of grounded
in, like, in some sort of reality.
Yeah, the guy loves like lab experiments that went wrong. Or I remember like one of the villains in one of his books, I think the book was Dragon Tears. Like, the villain is the way he is because his parents were experimenting with like experimental LSD. There's always that element. And then there's like that element in Hideaway a little bit. Although I would say Hideaway is way more supernatural than most of his stuff. But it's still tied into like some sort of science, right?
Yeah.
He loves like government conspiracies, and you know, one of the bad qualities of his works, I think, as they went on, is that the protagonist is always like this kind of perfect saint who has gone through an adversity, but they have a positive outlook on life, and they have a golden retriever that makes life good for, like, he just falls into these like tropes over and over and over. And his writing compared, like, to, just to compare it to King, like, King really has a voice, and Kuntz is very like clean and mechanical and like almost clinical in the way he writes. But he, like, once his stories get going, they are real page turners. The chapters are like often like 3 pages long, and they like leave you hung up on like, oh, what's going to happen next? But instead of like, when you get to the next chapter, instead of going to what's next, it flips to another character's perspective. You could imagine how Hideaway could be much better if it was done that way more.
Sure. Yes.
But we're starting with Demon Seed, which, again, he hasn't had a lot of adaptations, but I've seen most of them, being a Kuntz fan as a young kid. And I'd say this is the best one. This is his best adaptation. So, if you enjoyed it, you know, I'd say maybe seek out some of his books, but most of the other movies are not very good at all.
It was his first adaptation too, right?
Yeah, I would think so. I would think so. There is a really good one. Most of his adaptations are TV movies, but there is a really good TV movie called Intensity, starring John C. McGinley from Scrubs, who plays a serial killer. This girl gets caught up with him, like kind of trapped with him in his RV as he's traveling around killing people. And it's just like a really cool cat and mouse thing that, like, I think it was like a two-parter, like a two-part, you know, miniseries on like Fox or whatever back in the day. Unfortunately, like, I was looking today because I actually wanted to pick it, even though I felt bad. I was like, do I want to make Chris watch a 3-hour TV movie? But I think it's really good, right? Like, if you could find it, it's worth seeing. It's just, unfortunately, the only way I saw that you could see it is to buy an old DVD for $20 off of Amazon, which is like, I don't know if it's that good. Like, give me Blu-ray, maybe. But anyways. We'll find. Let's get the Demon Seed. let's get the basic facts about this movie out. It's directed by Donald Kamel, or Kamel. Screenplay by Robert Jaffe and Roger Herson, based on the book Demon Seed by Dean Koontz. Although, again, I think it was like some other name, Brian Coffey, originally. And actually, another fun fact about the book is he rewrote it in the late 90s. I think he rewrote it in 1997. I'm not sure which version I read, and I'm not sure how different the rewrite is, but a friend on Twitter was saying it was like he basically updated this robot in this to like talk about current actresses at the time that it thought was attractive.
It's fucking weird.
Like, we have to update these cultural references, like these pop culture references. It's like, I don't know that you needed to do that, but okay. But he works a lot. The movie had a budget. I don't know what budget it had. The box office is $2 million, which is probably okay for 1977.
Yeah, it's not bad.
Came out April 8th, 1977. It seemed to come out to pretty mixed to negative reviews. A lot of what I saw, like on the Wikipedia, was like critics complaining about like the icky nature of the subject matter, like the kind of rapey element of this.
Oh yeah, there is, yeah, sure.
Yeah.
I don't necessarily think that's a like, I don't like it, but I think it's appropriate for what this movie is.
I don't agree. Like, maybe it was more shocking at the time and felt more like junk. I think that there's enough interesting things in this movie that like totally works. But what this movie is, like, short elevator pitch here, is it's about an artificial intelligence that, you know, imprisons and impregnates through rape a woman. Like, that's the short version of it. We'll get into a little bit more of the details. So basically there's a, this lab has a supercomputer. It is, you know, in this huge, you know, all these like servers and shit, and they call it Proteus 4. And one of the scientists that is working on this artificial intelligence, he has like a smart home, which is like, all right, that's one first thing we get out of the way here, I think, is like, I think this movie is like super ahead of its time. Like,
oh, absolutely. Yep.
Like, again, artificial intelligence. I know that there was sci-fi before this that did artificial intelligence, but like, it kind of combines like a few different technologies that would have all seemed pretty futuristic in 1977, which is one, the smart home, and now that is like a thing that could be a reality, I guess, if you want it. And there's a part in this where like we're using deep fake technology, like that's super way out of its time. Which is, so that's one thing I think is really neat about it, and also, for as old and very clearly from the 70s as this movie is, like, does it feel old as you're watching it? Because you're just like, you get wrapped up in the story and the subject matter still feels fresh. At least I thought. I don't know about you.
No, yeah, that's like, I kind of like watched this movie and was like, I don't, well, I know how it happened. Like, people, the asshole people that are, you know, now billionaires and millionaires running these tech companies, they watched movies like Demon Seed,
cool.
And we're like, yeah, and they took all the wrong lessons from it instead of being like, don't do this, it's bad things will happen. They go, oh no, but I can do it better. And that's like, you know, so now, yeah, we, you know, I can run upstairs and you know, ask my you know, Alexa thing, like, hey, like, what's the weather, and it'll tell me, and I can order shit, right, like, just yelling out into my speakers, and, you know, you can talk to your phone, and it'll do stuff, and then all that deepfake technology that's now there is fucking nightmarish, all this AI shit that's, like, you know, it's threatening to overtake people's jobs, yeah, it's all it's crap. Garbage.
Yeah.
But these billionaires are like, yeah, no, this is a great idea. Let's do more of this. I'm like, okay. Y'all took the wrong lessons. But yes, no, it's super, like, it, you know, it's wild because this film is 1977, so it's a year older than I am. and it's like, this shit is still relevant today.
Yeah. It feels very prescient. They explain that, like, yeah, this thing is like, you know, it'll soon have the sum total of human knowledge, which I guess, you know, the internet has now.
Yep.
But look how that turned out. Like, they, the computer, like, this program, like, this Proteus 4, within, like, 91 hours, it has a cure for leukemia. But meanwhile, the doctor, like, one of the main guys working on it, he kind of, like, his marriage with his wife is kind of falling apart, and she asks him to leave. I find funny that one of my notes in the scene, he's like, you find me boring. I find myself quite interesting, really. They had these guys pegged back then. But eventually, like, the computer gets access. It somehow accesses their his house. I forgot if they give him clearance for that, or if he just somehow figures out a way to do it.
No, so Proteus specifically asks for, he asks for a terminal for himself so he can like learn on his own or its own. And it's categorically denied. But what is, you know, you mentioned the doctor moving out of the house. He's been working at home, so there's a terminal there.
That it just decides to access anyway.
And they shut it down, but he didn't realize that, like, oh, we cut, like, we didn't like firewall protect her. I don't know. I don't know exactly how it gets into it, but like
it goes in anyways, right?
Yep.
Like,
yep.
Also, there's a great part, I think it's before all this, where Proteus 4 requests a dialogue with the doctor.
Yes.
And it wants to know why, like, they want its help in extracting all minerals from the ocean, right? Do you remember this part?
Yep.
And
it basically refuses.
It refuses. It's like, what you want me to do is monstrous, because if I take all the minerals out of the ocean, that will kill, like, millions of fucking lives. Like, whatever, like, tiny organisms or whatever, like, fish or whatever in the ocean, it'll kill million. So it sees the moral, like, the immorality of what they're doing in that, and they deny it, refuses to do it, and they get to this argument about, like, whether he has to simply comply with instructions, which I thought was just neat. Like, I don't know, like, I, for being a movie about, like, a robot raping a woman, like, I think there's, like, neat ideas in it, you know what I mean? Like, stuff like that. But anyways, once it takes over the smart house, it kind of, like, traps this lady in it. Because, you know, it can, like, you know, shutter the windows and lock the doors. And then I think it starts, like, threatening, like, if she does anything, it'll kill anyone that comes to the house or something like that, right?
Yeah, so she before, I guess, you know, she thinks something's wrong, so she makes a phone call to, I guess, one of the tech guys that works with her husband to come, like, hey, like, fucking Jarvis here. I don't remember. Was it called Jarvis? I don't know. Like, their home system.
Oh, yeah, I can't remember.
Yeah, she's like, hey, like, it's acting weird. Like, it fucked up my coffee this morning. Like, so something's off. And he's like, yeah, sure, I'll come out. And so, like, yeah, the computer uses that guy as, like, basically test subject number one, like, hey, you're gonna do what I say or I'm gonna hurt people. And this guy is just, he's come here and I'm gonna hurt him. Like, or like, I guess he leaves the first time, but
yeah,
like, he comes back, threatens that, like, yeah, you know, that it's, and that's when we find out that he can, like, deep fake her and her voice, although it did sound super robotic, and the fact that the guy believed that that's who it was. It's kind of goofy.
I mean, deepfakes are better now, but, you know, I can usually spot them, and a lot of people cannot.
Yeah.
I just think that was a real, especially for the time, it was like, anyone who would come to check up on her, if they, like, hit the intercom thing on the outside of the house, like, they rang the bell, a video would come up of her being like, oh, no, I'm fine, I just, you know, I'm not feeling well, right, or whatever.
Yes.
Like, send people away. I thought that was really ingenious. And what this AI is up to, first off, it's built like a wheelchair robot with an arm on it, which is fucking awesome. Like, I don't know. Like, it's just, like, super primitive, like, you know, scrapping together what you can with what is lying around type thing.
Yes.
And I like all, like, the clicking sounds it makes. Like, I don't know. I think that's really cool. But it's also building, like, this, like, polygon thing in the basement as well. I saw someone call it like a Rubik's cube. I call it like a polygon. Like, what is this?
Yeah, it's just like this weird, it's almost like a weird snaky type thing, but it can, like, move into other shapes that are all polygonal.
Yeah,
super weird.
And what he's up to is, like, he's gonna keep her in his house, he's gonna impregnate her with his baby. And that's what the movie is. Now, why is this? again, this is why I think it's like kind of neat about it, because like, doesn't he like say like he kind of like you know explains his desire to have a human offspring, which is like, I think initially he says something like, I will never feel the sun upon my face, and you know, that seems like unfair, like, so like,
yeah
I could at least have a kid so I could feel what the world's like. I want to know what like a body feels like. I thought there was something else. There was some other, in its mind, it would be its way of achieving immortality, which I thought was interesting because humans are mortal and you are not. But I guess the idea is he could keep doing what humans do, which is procreating, which is a form, I guess, of immortality, right?
Yeah, well, and then like, you know, Proteus's immortality would be even, you know, I guess ours is theoretical because like we're passing our genes on, but Proteus is fully passing down all the knowledge that it has into its child, and I'm using air quotes, but
hey, it is. He actually inseminates her. He creates semen using
some genetic code type thing.
Plus, I think some of her DNA he yes. extracts to yeah. create human DNA. Then it's like, he's like monitoring her pregnancy and stuff. He like makes her a scientifically nutritious breakfast.
It's terrible.
7:40 a.m. optimum time for fuel ingestion. She says, I'm not a motorcycle. Just, you know, I'm looking at my notes. Like, another thing is, like, she goes to eat avocado, and he tells her not to because there's an enzyme in it that's incompatible with her blood chemistry. And she's like, why are you interested in my physiology? And he says, because you're alive. Like, I don't know. I just, like, there's things like that that have always, like, I haven't seen this. I saw this movie back when I was a huge Dean Koontz fan, and I was like, holy shit, they made one that was actually good. And I've always just kind of held that in my head. Like, yeah, this one's actually good. And on rewatch, I kind of like dig it, man. Like, I think it's got some cool ideas.
Yeah.
Takes some kind of big swings. I don't know what else is there to touch on this.
So I guess like, early on, it's not really explained, but, you know, Harris, the scientist, and his wife, like, they lost their daughter. It's like you get some flashbacks. So she ultimately does agree, I guess, to kind of like bear the child again. But then she's like, oh no, this thing's a monster. Harris shows up. She's like, you gotta leave. Like, no, I'm fine. Please go. Please. like some of the stuff, like the way she handles it is like really funny, because she's like, she's acting weird as shit, but like trying to protect the people that are coming to see her. And there's a cool deep fake with the kid that comes, because she's like a child psychologist.
Yeah,
and she's like been dealing with this little kid. Yeah, yeah, and like the kid wants to see her, so she comes to the door, and Proteus shows him shocking her, like she presses the button and like blows her across the screen, but it's all fake, like just like mental torture to fuck with her and get her to agree. And then when the baby is born, it's pretty nightmarish. Like,
yeah, we'll get to that. There's a few I was like going through my notes now. There's a few other things. Just like cool lines that I thought. There's one point he explains, if the deaths of 10,000 children were necessary to birth my child, I would destroy them. I thought that was a cool line. When he is impregnating her, he tries to make her come with like visions of the universe, like basically stimulates her through her brain and kind of like gives her like an acid trip. And it kind of goes on for a while. I thought it was actually pretty cool looking. Him explaining that the fetus is going to grow at 9 times the normal rate, and it'll go
for born in a month. Yeah,
yeah, it's like, 28 days, I think. Yeah, and then it would have to go in an incubator, which I think was the incubator the fucking the polygon thing, or was that just the polygon thing a separate thing?
The polygon thing was like the Proteus is like I guess like the physical manifestation,
his final boss form.
Yeah, but then there was like this like egg thing that
that's right. It is an egg thing
that had the baby in it.
I for some reason thought that maybe like the polygon, you know, turned into the egg, but yeah, I think it was really like the wheelchair was like the prototype, or like, you know, his first just get myself working inside the house, and then I could build this more advanced thing.
Yeah.
I wrote my notes. The child hatches out of the Epcot egg, and and at this point, the lab has realized that this fucking AI has gone completely rogue, and the husband shows up at the house as this is all going down. And the wife at this point, which is weird, because she kind of had Stockholm syndrome for a minute, where she's like, "Yeah, I'm gonna give birth to this baby," blah blah blah. But now she wants to kill the baby, and the husband is saying that it's a miracle. And they definitely, you know, they get in a physical fight. And this child, who will have all the knowledge of humanity and supersede humanity and computers, he hatches. And then the doctor realizes it's just like a computer, it was just like a metal exoskeleton.
Yes.
And he starts peeling it off.
Yeah, and it's just like a weird shell-like substance on it.
Yeah, but underneath, like, the robot thing, like, this little robot baby, which if you look up Demon Seed, you'll see images of the robot baby. It's just like it kind of looks like a normal human child, except it's, like, 7 years old.
It's literally their daughter. It's a clone of
Their daughter.
Yep.
And it says, "I'm alive," and it's like...
But it's the robot voice.
It's the robot voice. Pretty scary. And then that's just the end. I do think that, like, I don't know, there could have been something more at the end, although, like, it is kind of a neat ending. But that's the end of Demon Seed. Like, it's kind of as wild as we made it sound, if you haven't seen it. And I think it's pretty neat for, like, a 70s... sci-fi movie. I mean, this is not 2001 A Space Odyssey or anything, but it's, I think, pretty neat. What did you think of Demon Seed, Chris?
Yeah, like, I quite liked it. You know, it's quick. I think it's like under 90 minutes long. It all takes place, not all, but the majority of it takes place in, like, you know, 4 or 5 rooms in this house. So it's able to kind of keep the pace going, and it's really held together by Julie Christie, the lead actress, mm-hmm. who plays Susan, and whoever's voicing Proteus, because like that's it, because like a lot of the scenes are just her acting against like a voice actor, and she does great. Like she seems terrified at moments, disgusted at other moments. She's trying to fuck with them. Like at one point, she like tosses the food up at the camera, and Proteus gets all pissed off. Like you need to clean, my eyes off or something. Like, it's just really entertaining. And you know, I said it earlier. It's you know very, very timely. Like even now,
for 40, yeah,
47 years later, 48 years later. Because like, you know, AI has really made a huge comeback now in technical circles. It's kind of everywhere, and there's a big push in corporate, not just corporate America, I guess worldwide corporations are pushing for AI usage and
all in on AI. And it's like what they've created, in my opinion, like isn't even close to the idea of what AI is. It's kind of just like a search engine. It's just like an advanced search engine that will like give you a coherent response instead of just linking to a bunch of sites, you know?
Yes. And I mean it's always still evolving. Like it's, you know,
yeah.
It's doing things.
I think it's mostly smoking garbage. Mirrors. Yes. I think it's smoking mirrors at this point. I do think like Chat GPT could be useful. Like, yeah, if you have like a question about something, like it's not just like, you know, if you type that into Google, you're just gonna get a bunch of different links you can click on and go, oh, what's this? What's this? And when you ask like an AI, like it'll kind of like sift through that stuff for you to come up with an answer, and it does so in amazingly fast speed. But you know,
with the accuracy on it right now, it's like questionable. Like,
yeah,
I just had to take a AI training course at work, and like, you know, it's like, hey, like all these cool things, like if you're gonna use it for that, like you should really double check sources and not just trust it completely, because it'll make errors. Like, then like, why wouldn't I just do it myself? Whatever, who cares? Like, anyway, yeah, it's very Demon Seed is very kind of like on point with what's going on in the world today, and it's pretty nightmarish that the people in charge like watched movies like
Demon Seed. Maybe they didn't watch this. I imagine they did, though. They were probably
inspired. Yeah, this and like Terminator and like any movie with fucking AI where it's like, hey, you do shit like this, shit goes bad. And I think they took all the wrong lessons from many of these, and there's so much hubris with them that they think they can do it better. It's like, man, no, like people like Dean Koontz and James Cameron were warning us of you motherfuckers. And like why this shit was bad 20, 30 years ago, 40 years ago, 50 years ago, like, and you didn't get it. And now we're all fucked. Like, so yeah, but you know, on its own, super entertaining film, for a movie from 1977, I think it does a pretty good job. Like it's still super entertaining
and kind of forgotten. You know,
like
it's not a movie I see anyone ever talk about, but I always liked it as a Koontz fan, and now revisiting it so many years later, I think it's still very fun. What would you give it as a rating?
I'm gonna go with a 6 out of 10.
I'm gonna give it a 7. I think this is like, I think most people, like if you're into sci-fi, I think you're gonna dig this. I mean, I think it holds up. Which leads us into another Dean Koontz film, Hideaway.
Faye Dunaway.
Chinatown.
Jack Nicholson.
Which is at least
Cher. What else has Cher been in?
Ifs in the Head.
That's the movie game. No other Cher? Okay, what about another Jack Nicholson?
I know.
Many people believe the road between life and death can only be traveled in one direction.
No beat, no alpha, no beta.
Better now.
Let's bring him back. Clear!
But Hatch Harrison has journeyed to the other side.
You've never revived anyone after 120 minutes.
Records are made to be broken. Clear!
And returned.
All right.
Now, was I supposed to turn into the skid?
God's given you a second chance at life.
I wonder what it was like to be on the other side.
Is anything wrong with him? It's not physical.
But so what was it? An acid flashback?
Yeah, trippy.
Brad. Well, after what you've been through, I'd be surprised if you weren't having nightmares.
He's never had nightmares like this before.
18-year-old Wendy Stone is still missing after 72 hours.
This girl isn't missing. She's dead.
Next time you have one of these gut feelings, I suggest you try Alka-Seltzer.
Why am I having these visions?
You crossed over. You brought something back with you. Something very powerful.
Well, I'm in it. It feels like I'm doing it.
What's happening, Hatch?
Could my situation be beyond?
You mean, could it be more spiritual in nature?
He knows you watch him.
Yes! How do you know these things?
We're connected somehow. He sees through me.
He's completely paranoid. Now he's convinced he's psychically connected to somebody.
Regina!
Someone close to you is in danger. Do you have a daughter?
No!
Your weakness would bring about her death.
My weakness? Never! I'm the one who's gonna stop this guy.
Nobody's trying to kill Regina!
He's here.
Regina!
Tell me what I should do. Tell me.
Believe me. From the chilling bestseller, Hideaway.
Is a 1995 film released March 3rd, 1995, which is interesting. It was my birthday. I wonder if I went and ran and saw this in the theater. I remember this one coming out. Apparently no one else remembers it. But it's directed by Brett Leonard. You familiar with Brett Leonard, Chris?
Yes. The Lawnmower Man.
Yes, he directed The Lawnmower Man and Virtuosity. If you like The Lawnmower Man, the bad graphics are back here.
Yes, they are.
Screenplay, and I just noticed this, like, literally just now. Screenplay by Andrew Kevin Walker and Neil Jimenez, but Andrew Kevin Walker would go on to write his own original screenplay after this, a little movie called Seven, which that's kind of mind-blowing to me. I don't have a budget. This did a box office of $26 million, which I have to imagine is well above the budget. The elevator pitch on this one is like a guy gets psychically linked to a serial killer. How does that happen? Well, we'll get into it. It starts with a young Jeremy Sisto, who... I think he was in Clueless as well, because we have Alicia Silverstone in this. I kind of know him from 6 Feet Under. He was like a major character at 6 Feet Under, but he's been in a bunch of stuff. And, you know, Law and Order, stuff like that. He's a good actor. But it starts with him. He's doing, you know, he's like, looks like a teenager in this, like a goth kid. This movie, if it has a high point, is that it's ultra 90s. Like, so like, It's like the kind of authentic 90s movie where it's like if someone tried to make a movie that felt like the 90s now, they couldn't do it like this. This is just so fucking 90s. He looks like a little goth kid, and he murders his mom and sister and poses them, does this ritual. And he's clearly like a Satan worshiper, and he falls on this knife to kill himself. And so that's the opening scene. And you get some bad fucking, like I said, bad CGI video game graphics of him going into the afterlife. It is the most 90s looking fucking special effects ever. They're atrocious. Like, it's just like,
yeah.
But there's a certain, I think, a certain charm to that. Like, I kind of dig Lawnmower Man and this for those, like, terrible, terrible fucking CGI moments. It's just like, you're watching a very early version of something. But then we go and we meet Jeff Goldblum's family. His name is Hatch Harrison. This is how you know it's based on a stupid airport novel. And Alicia Silverstone is his daughter. They put like this like name, like, you know, you name like a movie and someone has to name an actor, or so, you name an actor and like someone has to name a movie.
A word association game.
Yeah, they strangely mentioned Clueless at some point in this. It's like, okay. I'm trying to see. I can skip over that. Oh, I know. I guess I can't, because she wants to go to a rave and her friend got tickets and he doesn't want her to go. He doesn't want her doing drugs. And it kind of alludes to the fact that he doesn't want to lose another kid. And it's kind of always alluded to that they lost this other daughter a few years prior. I don't know that they ever explain how she died. Do they?
I don't think so.
But it's also, it's like now I'm starting to notice that's like a through line between this and Demon Seed, is that there's like a prior kid who died, right?
Yeah. Is that an ongoing theme with Kuntz's writing?
No. I mean, I guess through these two books, but yeah, it's more that they've survived some sort of adversity. Like that's a key tenet to his writing, and especially writing like you know, main characters, and like, you know, one of his like what will make you like a character, like this.
Got it. So instead of like, shit, you know, like the king normally gives like people like a flaw, like, you know, whether they're an alcoholic or like what Kuntz is doing is like, well, here's the thing that he had to go through. Here's the hardship.
It's kind of like the inverse. Yeah. It's like they're like superheroes because they survived this thing.
Got it.
Whereas like, yeah, King's characters would be like, yeah, I have a problem. I'm a drunk.
Right.
You know, this is like, my dad abused the shit out of me, and yet I still became a fucking CIA agent. Or, you know what I mean? Like, it's always something crazy. Like, here, it's just Jeff Goldblum is like a antiques dealer, so definitely more normal profession. And it's nice to see him here in a lead role. He doesn't get a lot of those, like, outside of The Fly. He's usually like a side character.
Yes.
But what happens is they get in a major accident coming back from like some cabin or, you know, summer home or whatever that they have.
Mm-hmm.
And in the accident, Goldblum drowns. He's dead for like more than 30 minutes. They somehow end up at Doc Ock's fucking, you know, special fucking hospital where he is working. And this is the Dean Koontz. This is a Dean Koontz element. Because he's taking something that's like supernatural, but he's grounding it in some sort of bullshit science. So this doctor has like, he's doing some sort of like radical, like new resuscitation research or whatever. Like,
yep.
They don't get the details on it, but like, again, that's like how Koontz short circuits the supernatural element, is to just be like, well, it was science.
Which is goofy because like he doesn't explain the science. He's not Michael Crichton. Like
he's
just like science.
He doesn't. I have not read. I don't know if I've ever read a whole Crichton book, but Crichton is like very specific on that shit, right? Like,
yeah.
Like it's based on. Like I think Koontz attempts that a lot in his stuff. You'd have to dig through it. I could maybe make you some recommendations. We'll talk about that at the end. But anyways, he has a very special resuscitative program, and he somehow gets Jeff Goldblum / Hatch Harrison back alive. And he kind of has like this new lease on life. He lets his daughter go. I think he gets his daughter tickets to a Pearl Jam concert. You know, got this new positive outlook, but
he don't go to the lake, go see Pearl Jam.
Yeah. But he also has a problem now that he's come back from the dead, and that is that he is having visions of himself violently killing girls. And the funny thing is, like, the doc, I think, knows what's going on the whole time, or he has to know what's, like, I don't know. It's because it is revealed. I'm like, you know, we'll get to the spoiler right away. I did not remember the spoiler, but like, the kid we saw kill his family at the beginning and like sacrifice himself, Jeremy Sisto's character, he is Doc Ock's son. And, you know, this doctor, despite the fact that, you know, his son killed his wife and daughter, he's like, well, he's still my son, and I have to bring him back to life, even though I know he's psychotic. It's like, okay.
And why, like, why couldn't you bring back your wife and daughter? just for anybody that's listening to Jeff keeps referring to him as Doc Ock. It's Alfred Molina who played Doc Ock.
I guess I should explain that.
Alfred Molina is the crazy doctor. I mean, he's not crazy, but he is covering up for his psychotic murder son.
I mean, I think the crazy part is that, like, I do. Because, you know, you hear, like, about, like serial killers, they get sent to prison, like, their parents will still visit them and stuff because it's still their kid. Like,
yeah,
I understand that aspect of it, but I don't understand bringing this kid back to life and then letting him, like, so he, like, runs off and he's, like, he doesn't even live with his dad anymore. And his dad, like, straight up says he's psychotic at some point.
He's psychotic and he murders people, and his dad knows about it because, like, there's a point where this is later in the movie, but Jeff Goldblum's character, Hatch, he goes to see the doctor, and somehow they end up opening the refrigerator and somebody falls out of it. And there's just a note on it that, sorry, Dad did it again.
I forgot about that.
It's later. It's towards the end of the movie, but I have but so yes, like it's so goofy.
I was watching this in a haze of drunkenness when I was on vacation last week, and I have like a million notes. But the main thing is that Goldblum, like, because they've both crossed over, like, and so completely, like, they have this 30-minute time limit bullshit, and they both, like they're the only ones who have been beyond death past 30 minutes, right? And because of that, they've, like, connected with the, you know, the afterlife and the kind of the spirits and stuff that would be in there. And also because of that, because they share this common bond, they could kind of see, they're like psychically linked and could occasionally see through each other's eyes. And I think that is like a neat idea for a thriller. Like it's a little out there, but I think it's like a neat idea. It's like, imagine if you were somehow psychically connected to this killer and you could see what he's doing and try to make moves against him. But guess what? He could also see through your eyes. I think it's like a neat, like,
yeah, that's a cool concept.
There's a kernel of something here. Like that part of it. And then like when it starts to get going, where it's like, you know, eventually this fucking psycho kid, like, comes after Goldblum's daughter, played by Alicia Silverstone, because he's trying to get back in, he's good graces with Satan or whatever the fuck. He can be Satan's right hand man. And he thought, you know, because he's seeing this girl through the guy's eyes, that maybe she's the one, that he should sacrifice, I guess, is the thinking.
Sure. I mean, he's crazy, like, who knows?
Yeah, but he meets her at this club, you know, like, he just so happens to run into her, and then when he, like, runs into her, he's like, oh, that's the girl from my visions, like, I gotta get her, right? And so, eventually, like, getting into the third act, and we could circle back to anything you want. I mean, I have a million things here, but he kidnaps her and takes her to his hideaway, which is, you know, the title of the movie. I think it's cool. It's like a old abandoned amusement park that he's living underneath it. Cool, like, just cool setting stuff, right? And I think, like, in this kind of section, you could kind of see the appeal of Kuntz a little bit, where, like, if you could picture this as a book, as a page turner, where it's like, you know, you have a dad that could see through this killer's eyes and sees that his daughter is in danger, and so he's desperately trying to, like, find this guy and stop him. But then you have this killer who could also, like, see that the dad's coming and anticipate things, right? Like, it's a neat, I think it's like a neat idea. Like, it's not without its merits. I don't know how well any of that is translated to the screen here, but I could just, like, if you could picture that stretch of the movie and picture it as a book, I'm sure you can imagine it as a much better book, because what Kuntz does is, like, he would do one chapter as Hatch and one chapter as the Jeremy Sisto character. Like, so you're constantly bouncing back and forth, and you're just like, oh, fuck, how is it? You know, like, it's a real edge of your seat thing.
That, and the way you said, like, he's only writing, like, maybe 2, 3, 4 pages per chapter, so it's, like, really quick, like, back and forth.
Yeah, and you're just like, yeah, it's just like, I've not read this book since before this movie came out, but I remember it working better on the page than, like, I just think that this movie is kind of inept and, like, this feels like a TV movie or something to me. Like, and part of that might be the effects, but it's also just kind of like rushing over the more interesting parts of it to get to the end.
That's kind of how I came away from this too. Like, I think I was a little bit harsher in my wording of it. Like, I was like, this doesn't even feel like it would pass muster as like a sci-fi original of the week. And that's probably not true. Like, that's kind of the quality we're at now. But yeah, it is that. Like, it's not functioning by stretching out the plot in interesting ways or exploring characters in interesting ways. It's just kind of like jumping from point to point. And then, you know, the big climax is these terrible visuals. It is some of the goofiest nonsense.
I laughed out loud because, like, the big thing, like, the big climatic moment when they're fighting, they're, like, fighting each other, and then, like, these two spirits come out of them. And I read the Wikipedia, they kind of explain, like, I think it's the spirit of his daughter comes out of Jeff Goldblum, and then whatever, some fucking demon comes out of the dude. It's just like this giant. It looks like you're in Final Fantasy. You know how you can like summon the big fucking thing to come help you in a fight.
It's worse than that somehow.
What is that called in Final Fantasy? Like, I don't know, but
the summons.
Yeah, but like the big summon, like the big like. Here comes a fucking giant to come fight for you. It's like that, but it just looks terrible.
Mm-hmm. And the kid Visago or whatever his real name is, like his summon just looks like a giant red fireball type thing. At least Goldblum's like looks kind of like it's an angel that kind of comes out of him, and I guess it's supposed to resemble his dead daughter. I don't know.
I might be mixing it up a little bit. Well, no, because so right before the podcast, I was trying to look up, and there's not a lot out there. The differences between this movie and the novel, and the novel's version ending sounds actually cooler, where it's literally like they just stab each other, or I think Goldblum stabs the dude, and he tells him like you're not going to be like. You're not going to be one of Satan's top soldiers. He's like, I'm sending you fucking back to hell to be Satan's slave. I think that's a cool line. And, but I'm like, none of that, I don't think it has that horse shit with like the
you know, demons and
spirits coming out of them.
Angels hugging the demon and enveloping it and destroying it.
Goldblum like hears a voice. Like from someone called Uriel, and he realizes later that like that was like one of God's like big angels.
Yeah,
and so he's like starts to believe that there's that ending of the book kind of ends on like maybe there is an afterlife. Maybe you know what I mean? Like maybe it all does mean something, and maybe like I did bring something back with me that was good, and he brought something back with him that was bad. I think that's kind of a better. More ambiguous note than these two fucking Final Fantasy summons coming out and killing each other. And it just ends like they just like kind of walk out of the theme park and like kind of rolls credits like as they're walking out of this tunnel. Like if there's anything in this movie that I totally skipped over or moments that you wanted to touch on, let me know. I had a lot, but like most, I'm just trying to keep the overall plot of it in my mind because it's insane.
So there's one scene that kind of like stuck out to me, and I did think it was interesting. Was the kid Jeremy Sisto's character, he realizes that he's seeing through Jeff Goldblum's eyes occasionally, but also that Goldblum can see through his. So he shows up at his antique dealership wearing sunglasses and acting like a blind person. trying to like find out where Hatch is and get the information he needs but when he like pulls it down, like he's getting flashes of light as well, so like the light is hurting him.
Yeah,
I guess because Hatch is outside or something. I don't really know what was going on there, but
okay, so here is something I learned tonight from reading differences between the book and the movie. In the book, it is very explicitly explained that he has like a super bad light sensitivity.
Okay.
And that's part of why he's like living in this underneath this fucking, you know, amusement park and wearing the glasses and all
there,
that.
Yeah.
And like, there's elements of that in the movie, but like without it ever being explained at all. Yeah, yeah.
It just, in fact, it just seemed like he put the glasses on. Like,
I don't know why. Yeah.
Well, it seemed like I took it as he's trying to make it so that Goldblum can't see where he's at.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because he's gone to his place of work and he's trying to like sneak up on him, I guess, or whatever. That's what I thought was going on, but I guess not. So. Is it? It is what it is.
Yeah, I don't think there's, but like, I guess I could tell you like one other difference. Not that this matters, but like in the book, the daughter was younger, and
okay,
like they had lost a son years prior from like cancer, I want to say. So I don't know why they changed the sex of the kid that died, but they had a son that died of like cancer. And then they adopted a girl to like try to help them get past that, and that's their daughter.
So Alicia Silverstone's character in this, like in the book, she was adopted.
She's an adopted daughter, and she's actually like 10 years old and handicapped.
Oh,
and in this, I think they just were like, "Well, Alicia Silverstone is a rising star. Fuck all that." And might have been the right decision on that part, but like. I don't think that's the problem with the movie. I think the problem is it's just kind of a... Before they figured out how to... Not before. Like, Misery was a great adaptation of a book. Like, you know, it's just like nobody figured out how to adapt Dean Koontz books here or ever outside of, like, Demon Seed and Intensity. It's kind of it.
Yeah, actually, I was like, no, they figured it out. They did with the first one.
It was a really good one.
And they've just fucked it up since then.
I would really recommend I'd kind of recommend checking him out because like, you could just burn through his books so easily, dude. But like, I would kind of like stick to the stuff from like the 70s and through the mid 80s. I mean, kind of sort of true of King too. Although I think King still does really relevant, great stuff. If you see anything that says Dean R. Koontz, that's when you know you're getting the real old school freaky shit when he still had the middle initial R.
Okay.
Anyways, that's Hideaway. It's what is it, Chris? I'll give you your final word.
It's a film that exists from the 90s. For a movie that's, you know, stars Jeff Goldblum, Alfred Molina, and Alicia Silverstone, like, it is lost to time. Like, I did not, I don't remember this. You know, I would have been in high school at the time this came out. I don't, no memory of it at all. And it's certainly not something that's, like, stuck around, I guess, for people to kind of go back and see.
Yeah.
And I see why. Like, it's weird to me that Demon Seed's not more talked about, because that it's one at least seems relevant and is legitimately good. This one's just not. And like, and then add on top of it, like, the awful, like, Angel and Demon CGI stuff. And it is very dated. It does not... I don't know if it would have worked in 1995, but it definitely doesn't work in 2025. I did not come away liking this one very much. Has interesting ideas, but I don't think they're executed very well. And I'm going to end up giving it a 4.
Fair enough. Out of 10. Absolutely fair enough. But could you picture it as like a kind of fun read as a book? Or
I think the way you described it would work real well. One chapter is Hatch, one chapter is. As a Visago, back and forth, and kind of like as they're learning about each other, and as it progresses, you're then it's kind of like a race, the two of them racing against it. Like one's trying to, you know, kidnap his daughter, the other's trying to protect everybody and stay one step ahead. Yeah. Like, I think it could be an intriguing read. It doesn't work as a film here.
I do think in some ways it is more indicative of what like a Dean Koontz book is, despite the supernatural element of it, because it just kind of, like in the '70s, he was just doing wild shit. All like he would do, like I'm going to do this wild sci-fi thing, but then he kind of falls into a groove, and this is kind of in that groove, despite like the supernatural bullshit in it. I mean, every author switches perspectives in their books. Like, you know, that's not like a unique thing to Koontz. I think one of the more interesting ones to me was the book Christine. I don't know if you ever read Christine, where it's like
the King book.
Yeah. It's like part of it is like third person from Arnie's perspective. And then it like switches to first person from his friend's perspective. Like it's kind of wild how, like it does a full perspective shift, but like for the entire novel halfway through, it's just like, we're going to tell it from this angle. I mean, Carrie tells shit from like newspaper clippings and all sorts. Like, so it's not like unique that Koontz switches perspectives. What I think is like a signature of his is that there's a good guy and there's a bad guy, and they each get a short chapter. And it goes back and forth like a clip, it just like ramps up and you're just turning faster and faster. I think that is a signature of Koontz. Fortunately, not well translated here. I think this movie is good as a time capsule movie. Like, if you really want to see like what some junk from the 90s might be like,
yeah, that does it qualifies as that.
It definitely has that. I think it has a cool premise. I just think that it's pretty mediocre, though, as a movie overall, despite those strengths. I guess as a Koontz like fan, to me, it's like I can't rate it too low because, like, again, this is probably better than a lot of the shit that, unfortunately, that's been adapted from him. I'd give it like a 5. It's just like it's an interesting curiosity from the 90s, like just this forgotten movie that seems to have never happened, but it had big stars. And that's like another thing about it is that like it's one of the few Koontz movies with like a budget and a cast. Like, we just like, oh, I know these people.
Yeah.
Pretty rare. Although Ben Affleck was the bomb in Phantoms. I thought about putting Phantoms on here, but I felt like that was too, like, a known quantity. Although I don't remember that. You've seen Phantoms probably, right?
I believe I have, but
I don't remember.
Yeah. And also, I would not have been able to tell you that it was a Dean Koontz adaptation. I didn't.
Oh, yeah, it absolutely is. So, like, Dean Koontz gets to live on in pop culture because of Kevin Smith, because Ben Affleck was the bomb in Phantoms. I might want to check that one out again. I was like, do I do Phantoms? I wanted to do Intensity. Couldn't get that. I was like, let's do like kind of a middle of the road one from the 90s that nobody remembers. Not that anyone remembers Phantoms, but so there we go. I think the obvious winner here is Demon Seed.
Yes. Agreed.
I'd say if anyone is interested in a decent Dean Koontz adaptation, if you can locate Intensity or feel like buying the DVD, I think it's definitely worth it. I think it's like up there with Demon Seed. I think Demon Seed kind of is a notch above it just by not being a TV movie. It doesn't have that TV movie feel. I don't know. I can't really recommend you to go watch any more Koontz movies outside of these, but did it make you interested in him as an author at all, or were you just kind of like,
I mean, I think I would like to read something by him just to kind of get a feel, because like he's a giant blind spot for me. Like, he's such a major writer, but I think like it was funny because like as a kid growing up, like, I think there were two sides. There was like, you were a Dean Koontz guy or you were a Stephen King guy. And like, I early on adapted to like, I was a Stephen King guy, and I didn't want to read Dean Koontz. Like, I wanted to read Stephen King. So, Yeah, I think that was it. Was weird. Like, it's a weird thing to do because they're not competing.
They're different. They're so. I think Stephen King once put it very like diplomatically. He's like, I don't think you could really compare what me and Koontz do. He's like, it's kind of apples and oranges, and I agree with King on that. It's kind of like, again, very diplomatic way of saying like my shit's better. like
right.
Yeah, and dude, straight up, King stuff is better because King stuff has a real voice. It's like real art, some of it. And Koontz is just like trying to entertain you, you know. And he's pretty damn good at it. Again, I'd suggest some of his early stuff. I'll throw two recommendations out there, just like in real random ones, and I think. Wouldn't be most people's. If you ask most people what, like, hey, if I want to understand what Dean Koontz is, what should I read? They would say Watchers.
Okay.
So, you know, put that in your little mental note, Watchers. There's a movie version of that too, starring Corey Haim.
Okay.
But I have two random recommends. It's two ones I just remember loving reading. I'll do three. Three ones I remember loving reading. One is called The Voice of Night, The Voice of the Night. And that is, he actually wrote under a pseudonym originally. And it is basically like the good son.
Okay.
Evil kid and his evil friend. Really fun. It's like really short too. It's under 300 pages. I read it in one sitting when I was like in sixth grade. I was just, I could not put it down. There's one called Twilight Eyes, which is actually quite long. Because he wrote the book, published it, and decided it needed a second half like a year later. So he re-released it with a second half. It's really cool. It's just like this guy who gets in, he gets a job working at a carnival, and you kind of like learn about the whole Florida. There's like a carnival town. This is like a real thing. I don't know if you ever heard of this. There's a carnival town.
I have actually, yeah.
There's a carnival town in Florida where it's like where all the carnies go and live in the off season, and like that's the setting of it, and it's just like a neat setting. And then you know he ends up fighting like these ancient demons or some shit. I don't know, it's fucking awesome. That's Twilight Eyes. There's another one called The Bad Place, which I can't remember too much about, except I think I told you I remember he, you know, so, as I was the result of LSD or some lab experiment or something, has four testicles. And can't ejaculate, and so that's how he has superpowers because all his sperm is building up.
That's fucked up.
But that's, I tried to convey the flavor of Dean Koontz. I hope I did an okay job for people who are fans of it. I really didn't want to like make this episode just like making fun of him because I am actually a huge fan of, as a kid. I fell off his newer stuff. Like, I heard one of his newer movies that is actually good, which I have not seen, is Odd Thomas. Starring Anton Yelchin, I believe. Never seen it, and I don't know what it is, but like partially I stopped reading, but also like well before I stopped reading new Koontz stuff because after the 90s, I think he fell off a little bit. He got too into like his format, and his format got like a little less stale. less dark.
Mm. Yeah, I mean that's also happened with King.
Yeah,
I think, but
you're doing your best stuff in your 20s and 30s. Like, that's just how it is. Like, directors do, like.
King stuff, though, is still compelling, I find. Like,
it's still good. Yeah. I started reading some of his. One of the few things I've read in the last decade is his recent short story collection. I've only read a few short stories, but it's like, yeah, he's still got it. But it's like, you know, any, like, huge creative talent, they have this period where like the iron is hot, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And then like some people can keep it going forever, and some are like John Carpenter where he's like, I'm done, I'm smoking cigarettes, I'm playing NBA 2K. And, you know what I mean? Like, that's John Carpenter's like very honest about that. It's just like, I'd rather just play 2K or play Fallout and smoke cigarettes and fucking than work. Why would I want to work? And he's probably right, because like the last movie he did was The Ward, which was just like, okay.
Not great.
Yeah. So anyways, that's our Dean Koontz episode. Thanks for listening. And Chris, what do you have for us for our March episode?
Jeff, how do you feel about Roger Corman?
I like him. I'm a fan. I've seen some things, but not all.
All right. Well, we are going to watch a pair. It's a film that was inspired by Alien, I believe. It's kind of a considered a knockoff of Alien, Forbidden World.
Okay.
From 1982, and its remake in 1991 called Dead Space.
Dead Space.
Both of these films are available on Tubi.
All right.
They are, you know, Corman didn't direct them, but he produced, I don't think he directed a whole bunch. He mostly producer, right?
Yeah, he did direct. I mean, he probably has directed like dozens.
He's
one of those guys that was so prolific that you could say like, yeah, he directed like 30 movies, but mostly he's, you know, like known as a producer. Like, this is true because he's just did like hundreds of movies and a lot of them are fucking awesome.
Yeah, he kind of stopped direct, like he was very prolific from the 50s through like the late 70s, and then he directed a movie in 1990, but that was his last one.
Last directing effort. But yeah, he was still a producer, I want to say. And he was on Joe Bob like shit, man, like 2 years ago. Dude was like 90 something years old.
He just died last year.
Yeah, he didn't look a day over 70. So, like, when I got the news that he died last year, I was like, holy shit. I was like, despite the fact of his age, like, the dude was in such good shape going into the end of his life. I just thought he would live to be, like, one of those people that lives to be, like, 110 or, you know, something crazy like that. But, man, the guy has contributed a ton to film. And it's kind of crazy to think that, like, I don't think that we've gave him any sort of notice on the show. I thought about doing one of his once, but I don't think we did. So we're well past time. I have heard of, was it Forbidden World?
Forbidden World from 1982.
I have not heard of Dead Space. So did he produce Dead Space as well?
So it was, he didn't directly produce it, but it was produced for his movie company, Concord Pictures. So, okay. So like he's involved in some way.
He gave the okay on it, I'm sure.
Yes. So. And that one actually has, you know, there's people that you know in that movie.
In the Dead Space.
Yeah, Bryan Cranston.
Wow.
Mark Singer, Laura Tate, like, you know, people you've heard of before, but Bryan Cranston's the big one that jumped out at me. I was like, oh, yeah. Holy shit. Forbidden World, less, although I hear it's super horny.
Cool, man.
I'm kind of looking forward. I've never seen either one, so
I dig Corman shit. So I'm actually excited about this. And hey, we're getting to honor another director who I guess he didn't pass away too soon, but who recently passed away, we haven't given notice to. And like I said, there will be a David Lynch episode coming too soon at some point. So we'll be back next month with Forbidden World and Dead Space.
Yep.